Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Catherine Hughes. She's Emerita Professor of Life Writing at the University of East Anglia, and a literary critic for The Guardian. And we're talking about her new book, Catland, Lewis Wayne and the Great Cat Mania. Catherine, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about Catland.
And it's a real thrill to be here, Mark. Thank you.
I have to ask you, how did you come to write this very unusual story?
Well, I'm a historian.
I've interviewed a lot of historians, and nobody's written Catland.
I know. Thank you. Well, I love cats. My grandmother was a cat breeder, and I grew up with cats. And I also grew up with the work of Lewis Wayne, this very strange artist who made these weird pictures of cats in the late 19th century. My grandma had all those. And I was just really, really intrigued by the fact that nobody had really written a kind of, imaginative book, by which I don't mean something that's made up. Everything is rigorously kind of tied to the sources, but tries to get inside why Britain and America suddenly became cat mad in the year 1880. I'm interested in why that would happen then, after centuries of nobody paying really any attention to cats at all.
And I love the way that you've done the book too, because there's a chapter on Lewis Wayne, then there's another chapter on Catland. And I should ask you, give me a definition of Catland.
Ah, that is the word. I describe Catland. It's a phrase that Lewis Wayne used, but it's a phrase. It's not. It doesn't belong to him. It's just a kind of expression that was knocking around in the 1880s. I see a place more as a time. So I would say 1870 to between 1870 and the outbreak of the Great War in 1914. It's a kind of imaginative space and place where people start thinking and looking at their cats differently. So whereas before, cats were just there as part of the furniture. I mean, they were often just confined to the kitchen to keep the rodents away, or the farmyard to keep the rats at bay. Suddenly, people started looking at their cats a different way and thinking, maybe these could be, I mean, they're never going to be dogs. They're never going to be sitting at your feet looking at you in a very adoring way.
Thank God.
But maybe there's something else there, maybe something even more interesting than dogginess, a sort of extraordinary wildness that is prepared to cohabit with humans for as long as it suits both sides. And so Catland, I think of as partly a kind of mindset. It is also because of these extraordinary pictures done by Lewis Wayne, this extraordinary artist who was a household name both in Britain. It is also a place where cats run amok. So, I mean, I should probably explain, if people don't know Lewis Wayne, he does these anthropomorphic pictures. So his cats are playing tennis, they're going to the they're quite argumentative, so they're often having boxing matches. They go to school.
They get drunk.
Love. They get very, very drunk a lot of the time. It's so interesting to see the way in which male alcoholism or drunkenness was treated as some extraordinary joke in the 1880s, 1890s, you know, with no sense of addiction or anything like that. Sort of jolly thing that men and cats got up.
His cats, I don't think it was ever a big thing here. I'm sure they came over, but when I looked, the only cats I knew by Lewis Wayne are those very famous paintings he did towards the end of his life, which are they're very psychedelic. And I remember reading a book on schizophrenia, and then they were used as an example of the mind degrading, which I don't want to talk too much about it and give away your book. But it was amazing to look at his other paintings of Catland. I found them quite disturbing.
Which ones, can I ask, Mark, the late ones, the psychedelic ones, or the early ones where people are just playing tennis?
I think that's disturbing. I found the other ones, okay, they were just sort of very design-oriented, the psychedelic ones. The ones where he's in Catland are just weird. And they started out one way, and they sort of progressed and evolved into these very strange images of cats doing human things.
I'm so glad you said that, because even in this country where Louis Wayne is, you know, very, very well known, people still often say in a very sort of unthinking way, oh, he... I know as a little girl, when I saw them, when I saw my grandmother's copies of Louis Wayne paintings, I was completely terrified, because it seems to me, as you beautifully put it, there is something very disturbing going on. So on the one level, it's late Victorian Edwardian society. Everybody's dressed up in their best clothes, having a jolly good time at the theatre, or even going to work, or going to the gentleman's club. But there's always tension. There's always a kind of simmering unease. So, I mean, very, very, very often his courtship pictures, by which I mean, you know, people falling in love, dating pictures, I suppose you'd say. There's always a sort of asymmetry. Somebody always loves somebody a lot more than somebody else. Or there's two boy cats and one lucky girl cat. Or there's two very cross lady cats and one very smug-looking boy cat. There's always a kind of... Somebody's always getting the bad end of the deal, really. And that goes with tennis. The cats constantly... They just cheat. I mean, they lose the line.
There's this weird anarchistic sense just below the surface. I mean, it seems like at any one point in time, they would just stop and just go wild and scratch and bite and yell. I mean,
but I think that's exactly what Wayne is so good at. He's painting cats doing these apparently very human things like going to the bank or running errands. There's a cat psychology there, which at any moment, you're absolutely right, civilization will break down, these cats will rip off their clothes and go and do cat-like things. So you always get the sense that civilization is just whisker deep, basically. It's always about to be disrupted.
He was a very strange person. Talk to me a little bit about his early life. It was very disturbing.
It's a sad story. He was born in 1860, which makes him slap bang a Victorian, right in the middle of Victoria's reign. Born to a sort of, I guess we would say, lower middle class family. His husband, who was also an alcoholic, in a very sad sense, not in a sort of jolly Louis Wayne sort of sense, but in an actual horrible dying at the age of 50 with delirium tremens, absolutely horrible. His mother was a very, very pushy woman. She was a woman of some skill. She was a very, very skilled embroideress, making very beautiful images for churches in the way of kneelers and vestments and so forth. So there was real artistic kind of ability there. But Wayne is the eldest boy, and then there's five girls who come afterwards, which means, very sadly, at the age of 21, when the father dies, he is in charge of providing this, you know, household of women. Because at this point in Britain, it's still not really possible for women sort of background to go out and work. So, I mean, that is an extraordinary burden to put on a 21-year-old boy. And he goes out to work, kind of a visual reporter. He would like to be doing all sorts of things. But what he finds, amazingly, his pictures of cats are the thing that absolutely catches the imagination. And editors can't get enough of his work. And so he literally becomes this machine. Sometimes he reckoned that he was sometimes producing 1,000 cats a year.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary rate of work. So he's a little machine, right? It's a sort of industrial kind of complex.
It was weird. I don't want to say he was a one-trick pony, but once he got into the Catland thing, he could really not get out of it. There's a bizarre political cartoon that he did with an octopus that you have in your book. And it just doesn't really work. You know, he's drifted too far from Catland.
Absolutely. He would love to have been doing very clever, kind of smart political commentary, perhaps even something that would go into Punch, say, our great satirical magazine. But when you're absolutely right. Whenever he tries, it never works. It just doesn't work. It's labored, it's mannered, it just doesn't come off.
The other problem, though, is the audience. I mean, the audience was going gaga for the cats. So, I mean, no matter what he did, people wanted his cats.
I think so. I sort of think of him as a slightly kind of old vaudevillian in a way. I mean, there's something of that, which is that, you know, he had something that he could do. He refined it by endlessly repeating it. And when he tried to do something different, nobody wanted him to do anything different. And so he was literally like that old entertainer, you know, still doing the same old stuff over a period of 50 years. I mean, I think it must have been very frustrating because he was a man of, I think, skill. That's debatable. Some people say he's not a very good draftsman. Other people say that he is. But we know from his private sort of reading and so forth, revolutions. So, you know, he will have seen Picasso. I'm going now into the early 20th century. He will have seen Picasso. He will have seen the Italian futurist. He did go to the exhibitions. He became very interested in Japanese art. Now, this is not a man without culture. But unfortunately, he's never really allowed to express it in a way that's kind of meaningful.
He's also rather quirky. He had a hair lip. Mm-hmm. And just constantly wore a big bushy mustache to cover it up.
Yes. I mean, I'd say, you know, that being born with a hair lip now, of course, is not significant at all. That is something that's repaired very, very quickly in newborn babies. But at the time, there was no way of repairing it. So that meant, you know, an extraordinary amount of teasing as a young child when he went to school. He got beaten up a lot, you can imagine. And luckily for him, bushy moustaches actually became very fashionable at the time, around 1880. So very, very sensibly, he hung on to that. Very grateful that he wasn't born a girl, because I think truly for women who are born with that particular disfigurement must have been absolutely
horrible.
Horrible. It's very difficult to retrospectively diagnose people. Not only is it sort of, but various sort of psychiatrists have come out and said perhaps he was on the spectrum. He was neurodivergent or autistic.
Right.
Other psychiatrists in the mid 20th century, when he was still alive, but locked up in lunatic asylums, suggested schizophrenia. But that doesn't quite work either for a variety of reasons. And so I think we just have to, in a way, leave him in his unique strangeness, which is only our own unique strangeness, if you know what I mean. It is the human condition. And I haven't reached a sort of position, and I'm not sure it's terribly useful to say he was suffering from this. He was certainly a strange, odd, antisocial man. We can definitely say that.
He had cats on the brain. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Catherine Hughes. She is Emerita Professor of Life Writing at the University of East Anglia and a literary critic for The Guardian. And we're talking about her book, which I strongly recommend. Even if you're a dog person, read this book. Catland, Lewis Wayne and the Great Cat Mania. Now, Catherine, I want to talk about some of your other information I learned about cats at this time period. You paint an interesting picture of what life was like for cats and what cats were like before Catland and Cat Mania hit Britain. You sort of describe cats as sort of looking like a dung-colored weasel and hanging out in alleys, and they were like victims of boys' pranks left and right.
Yeah, absolutely. They were the lowest of the low. So basically, most of them live outside homes. They live, as you say, down alleyways in barnyards. And because they are they don't have an incest bar, let's put it like that, with cats. They reproduce amongst themselves. which is never very good for genetic stock. And so that would become more and more inbred. You would get these colonies of feral cats, very inbred, very strange looking. And they have been described as looking like weasels. And certainly if you look at illustrations from the early 19th century, so that's before photography, you will see that people tend to paint them or draw them as particularly unattractive weasels with very kind of weird tails. And
very thin tails, very, very thin tails.
Very thin tails. And of course, this has an extraordinary psychological effect. I mean, it's very hard to feel affection for such an unattractive looking animal. And so one had the sense that the cats were the lowest of the low. They were employed, as it were, in households vermin, but they were in themselves a kind of species of higher vermin themselves.
Wow.
In Britain, for instance, gamekeepers, men who are employed to as well, keep gentlemen's estates free from vermin, would shoot cats, and then as a sort of tally would just pin them up on their wall to show how many cats they got, rather as you might have done with a fox, say, for instance, or an actual weasel. So they literally are the lowest of the low. And that means that other, you know, disenfranchised of the population, like small boys, love to make merry with them, love to make sport. And there's a lot of absolutely horrible stories about casual animal cat cruelty.
Let me stop you there, because I learned so many unusual things from your book. Talk to me about the Great Cat Massacre.
Ah, yes. That is something that happens in the 1730s.
Yep.
Before Catland. It happens in Paris, on the left bank of the Seine, where two apprentices decide, they are given permission by their boss, their master, who is a printer, to please round up all the stray cats because they're making such terrible noise at night. So please just round them up, get rid of them. We don't want them. And these two rather thuggish teenagers take their master at his word and literally round up these cats and then hold mock trials in which they accuse these cats of not only being possibly in league with the devil, but also, and I think this is key for these sort of 15-year-old boys, of living nicer lives than these poor kids do themselves. So there's a worry, in particular in France at this time, that middle-class women are beginning to feed their pet cats, because people did, you know, individuals would have pet cats, are feeding them nicer food than they're feeding to the apprentices. And as a result, these boys, as they stage a sort of mock trial, and then unsurprisingly find all these cats guilty and hang them or smash them with sticks. I mean, it is a massacre. It's a massacre.
Well, let's move on to a happier subject, a weirder subject. Harrison Weir.
Yes.
The man hailed as the father of cat fancy.
Yeah.
How was he inspired to do this?
Well, Harrison Weir is one of the great artists of natural life in the early to mid 19th century. He paints beautiful pictures of farmyard animals, but these are farmyard animals that are, as it were, the pride and joy of their owners. So prize cows or beautiful hens that have been bred to perfection. So that's how he gets into it. He becomes very interested in the beautiful side of animals. And then he changes his gaze slightly and starts in that kind of, in his arena. That's very strange at the time. People can quite understand a man like him wanting to paint a beautiful dog, even a beautiful hen, or a prize pig, but a cat? And he does some lovely pictures of cats and becomes a great advocate for their welfare. So he's a famous man, an important man.
But he's the one who develops the first standards for judging a cat.
That's right. I mean, Weir makes this really crucial point that as long as a cat looks like a really nasty, weasel. Nobody's going to feel very, very pleased or interested in its welfare. So he makes the very crucial point. Treat our cats with kindness. They will reward us by looking nicer. Breed them carefully. Weir was himself an amateur naturalist. He bred prize poultry. If you breed them carefully to produce cats that have lovely fluffy tails and, you know, perky ears, a gorgeous silky coat, you will start to feel more affectionate towards them. It is a virtuous circle. And Weir was, in a sense, I mean, Weir was a great friend of Charles Darwin, the great scientist who suggested that breeds could be improved by careful and selective breeding. Weir takes up the challenge. Darwin thinks it can't be done with cats. Weir thinks it can. And Weir starts to lay down standards for breeds of cats. So he suggests that a tabby should have its ears placed particularly high on its forehead, or a British Shorthair should have particularly creamy coat. He lays down very precise instructions for what your cat should look like if you want to produce a really beautiful and potentially prize-winning cat. And that, I think, is the key moment for breeds who start to want to produce beautiful cats.
What's amazing is there are people who then promote the idea that you can make big dollar signs by breeding cats. And people start looking at it as like a business to aspire to breed cats.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think it's a particular boon for middle-class women, certainly in Britain, but also in America. Again, we're talking about a cat. Well, certainly in Britain, can't go out and work in a shop, doesn't actually want to train to be a school teacher, but needs to make a bit of extra money. And so breeding cats at home is particularly popular, for instance, amongst vicars, clergymen's daughters, because it's a sort of genteel pastime. You can breed cats at home, make them more beautiful, and then start to sell them. Even Queen Victoria's favourite granddaughter, another Victoria, Princess Victoria, gets in on the act. She, believe it or not, wants to make a bit of extra cash, and she starts breeding cats at Windsor, where she lives, near to her grandmother, the Queen. So it becomes a very useful way for, I think, slightly disenfranchised and slightly impoverished, but genteel and certainly respectable middle-class women. It's a very good hobby to do at home. And in that sense, I think it's really quite interesting. Of course, what happens is that one or two very entrepreneurial types of people do start breeding and turning it into a big business. And there's one particular woman, another vicar's daughter, called Frances.
Oh, yeah.
She's great.
Wrote the column, Our Cats.
Yes. There's a wonderful magazine that starts called Our Cats, and she has an advice column in it each week, called, without any sense of double entendre, Practical Pussyology. And in it, she writes about all the things to do if you want to breed cats for... she writes a book called Cats for Pleasure and Profit, which I think is quite an interesting title.
Whoa.
And her particular thing is she's very, very good at sending cats overseas to America, because women in the States, particularly around Chicago and New York, are getting interested in this idea of breeding cats for profit. And Frances Simpson actually sends out cats on spec. So rather like dollar princesses who are coming the other way, coming out from, we're coming over the Atlantic to marry impoverished members of our aristocracy. Frances Simpson sends cats the other way. So they go out and are bought by quite wealthy women in Chicago and New York.
But you have to have the paperwork.
You have to have the paperwork. You're absolutely right. There's a bit of an unpleasant skirmish about whether these are actually whether these animals are actually farm animals on which no duty is paid, or are they luxury goods like a lace tablecloth or something on which duty must be paid. So there's a very, very interesting tangle with the American authorities about how these cats should be, as it were, categorized. But
We're almost out of time, and there are so many digressions that are just amazing and wonderful to read in this book. It's such a pleasure. You get to learn that that a pussy bachelor was a term at the time to identify men who were queer.
Yeah.
Because cats were considered effeminate. Now, there was, and that's like Edward Lear, the famous nonsense writer and also artist. But what phrase really stuck with me is, I never knew before, cats meet men, which are the guys that go out and find scraps and sell them to cat owners.
Yeah, that's right. It's a really important, I think, sort of intellectual shift. When people start thinking, I'm not going to expect my cat just to catch his own supper, I'm going to actually pay a penny a week to a cat's meat man, who is a sort of itinerant vendor who sells really nasty horse flesh. I'm going to pay a penny a week and buy this meat for my cat, so he's not just catching mice in the basement. And it's a slightly creepy kind of activity.
Oh, it is. It was in Mayhew's London Labour and London Poor, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And Dickens, great friend of Mayhew, also wrote about it. He was completely fascinated by it.
Oh, we're completely out of time. We honestly could talk about this book for hours. It's that great. My guest tonight has been Catherine Hughes, Emerita Professor of Life Writing at the University of East Anglia, and a literary critic for The Guardian. And we're talking about her book, Catland, Lewis Wayne and the Great Cat Mania. Whew. Catherine, it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. I've loved talking to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.